Good day to you. Welcome to Throwback Thursday, or as we call it, a TBT. We being the collective 7 billion people on the planet, Throwback Thursday is now just TBT, or Pound TBT, Life 2.0 podcast. There's a lot of lessons in looking back. Sometimes, you know, like the Boston song, Don't Look Back, you might just get stuck there. But I think you could spend a little bit of too much time in yesterday, but there are some great lessons to be learned when we take a look back, whether it's on Thursday, Tuesday, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or whatever. This particular case, of course, somebody came up with TBT, and we're just going to follow that. And you should be thankful for the editing that's been done on this, because it's a little bit early in the morning. It's about 95 degrees already. I'm sweating like Miley Cyrus at a PTA meeting. My throat's a little rough, so I had to take care of a little business, and you didn't even have to hear it. So all good there. Perspective is everything in life to me. It really is. Depending how you look at things, really to a great extent, my experience, observation, and opinion is, determines the experience you have in life. So, as I've mentioned, and this is not new, didn't think this up myself, you know, that two people could have the very same incident happen in their lives, and one sees it as an accident, and the other sees it as an incident. And there's a vast difference to both those things. An accident is something happens to you. An incident, in my opinion, is something you participate in, and you don't have to be a victim of it. So when I look back at the many things in my life that I thought were accidents, as my consciousness changed, they turned out to be incidents. And I was able to let go of some of the angst and the anger and the deep grief and all the other things that go along with thinking, look what happened to me, as opposed to look what I made happen so I could grow. That is not easy to do. I don't always get it right. And that's what Connected Dots are all about, looking backwards to see where you've been, because you don't know what's coming in the next moment or the next day for sure. Over the years on Facebook, like everybody else, you jump into the electronic landfill and you dump a bunch of stuff in there. And those are all images, right? So I can see what I used to look like in 19, none of your business what year it was. And I don't look like that anymore. But so much of me on the inside hasn't changed one iota. I'm not always sure if that's a good thing or not. I often feel like a brontosaurus or a tyrannosaurus rex or a stegosaurus, or my favorite, a triceratops, some sort of beast that is extinct and had its time and wasn't able to adapt to the changes that came on the planet. Now, none of them did, so, you know, I get that. But on a human level, just in the last 13 years, we're going to go back to 2005 in just a minute. In the last 13 years, I look at how much has changed. 2005, YouTube was just starting. I mean, you know, so there's a whole swath of humans who know YouTube is always being there. Young people, I call it MeTube, because it really is about, look at me. And I have a YouTube channel or a MeTube channel, and I think there's 4 or 6 videos on there I did 3 years ago. I still get people subscribing to it, and I'm not, look, you just got to call it what it is. I mean, I'm tech savvy, but I don't know that I want tech taking over everything that I do. And while it's a great way to get the word out, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time doing a bunch of videos, sticking them up on MeTube for any particular reason. So just being clear about that. Now, the podcast, of course, is something I can do really easy. It took me about 9 minutes to get all this stuff connected and fired up and ready to go. And I've already gone through some audio, and that's been the big kicker. I have done radio so long that I literally have Rubbermaid boxes filled with cassettes and CDs, no 8-track tapes. Even though when I started, we used what was called a cart machine. So anybody that's listening that's done any radio for any length of time, when you used to do commercials, you would take out what looks like an 8-track tape. It was already recorded on there. Somebody had recorded a commercial like they would now digitally, and they were marked with a label, and you would take that out of the rack, and you'd put it in the cart machine. It looked like a little toaster, or maybe obviously like an 8-track player that would have been in a car, except it had like 3 slots, 1, 2, 3, and then you'd rotate them. And so you had to manually fire those 30-second or 1-minute spots, as we call them. And when I first started in 97, I didn't know what a cart machine was. I knew what an 8-track was, but the process was fascinating to me, because it was very much more hands-on and not digitally taken care of as it is now. And so I don't have anything on carts, and I don't think I even have an 8-track anywhere within the sound of my voice at this point. But the deal is that I have so much material and so many conversations that I haven't listened to literally for years. And then when I go back and I dredge this stuff up, I go, wow. I mean, first of all, what was said 13 years ago is mind-boggling to me, because on some ways things have, we thought it was bad then in 2005. It was the end of the world. George Bush was president. Gas was $3.18. Pretty much what it is today. So in 13 years, we pretty much stayed the same. And gas prices to me is one of those indicators. Totally refused to let it tick me off because I can't control it. And yet, when the masses see the gas prices rises and it affects their pocketbook, then, you know, then they finally have congressional hearings and people pull back. I will say that in the Obama administration, during those 8 years, we were able to divest ourselves of about 46% of foreign oil because of domestic oil production that was done relatively safely. And we stockpiled stuff. And because of that, the prices dropped precipitously. I don't know what's going on right now. I try not to spend a lot of time in there, but I think it says a lot that 13 years later, the one constant is the gas prices are the same as they were basically 10 years ago plus three. So looking at across the board of all the stuff that was going on in 2005 was prompted by a CD, one of hundreds that I have, that simply said EH on it. And EH to me is Earl Hamner. And you, of course, know Earl Hamner if you're, you know, over like 35 or 40. He was the creator of the Waltons. And Earl was such an interesting guy, and I don't remember exactly how we met, but we became good friends over the radio and over the years, and I just had to listen. I had to go listen to it. Now, there are a bunch of conversations with Earl. I may find it another time from even earlier on in the 1900s, kids, like from the 20th century. But this particular one is from 2005, and it's built around a book that came out by Jim Persons that wrote about Earl Hamner. So Earl had, you know, done all this writing. He wrote for the Twilight Zone. He created Falcon Crest. Waltons was a huge hit and still remains something that people just hook into all these years later. And my favorite book, I'm sure you can still get it, is called The Avocado Drive Zoo. And it's about Earl's existence really in Studio City, California, with his beloved wife, Jane, who's also passed. Earl passed in 2016 and Jane not much longer after that, which ties them together in, you know, in the great scheme of things forever. Just a delightful woman. And he was just everything that you heard in his voice on the Waltons. He was that, really. He was just that transparent soul that just had so much to say and so much to offer a world that was rapidly changing. It started with his book, really, Spencer's Mountain. And then there was a movie of the same name in 1963 about a family in rural Virginia during the Great Depression. And then a television movie was called The Homecoming, A Christmas Story. That came out in 1971, and that became the television series The Waltons. So beginning in 72, the series subsequently aired on CBS after that for 9 seasons. And then after it was canceled in 1981, NBC got 3 more television sequels out that it wasn't so good. But the original set and the original idea and the original group of people that brought this to life in 1972 was in the fictional town, of course, of Jefferson County, Virginia. The real place was from where Earl was born and raised, which is Schuyler in Nelson County, Virginia. And the show was set from 1933 to 1946 during the Great Depression, and which arguably is one of the most difficult times in the history of our country. And it comes out in 1972 just as another very difficult time in our country was getting to where it was going to start winding down, but it was still pretty furious in Vietnam. And by this time in 68, 69, 70, 71, you know, everything was really, the pressure was all ramped up. The whole thing, you know, had been running for so long, and body bags were showing up on the news. And I mean, back then we were horrified to see that. I mean, because there's the real body count. And there was a lot of uproar. Kent State had already taken place, and people needed a rudder. People needed to be reminded of what was good and true and possible when families stuck together through difficult times. And over the years, the conversations I had with Earl really spoke to that. He said he was surprised more than anybody else that the series took off like it did, that it hit this deep vein of Americana that so many of us hold near and dear to our hearts, while all the other shit's flying around. There's some sort of American backbone that surpasses all the other stuff that distracts us. And the lessons that came from that show, of course, were told through John Boy Walton, who was Richard Thomas, and he played Earl Hamner in the show. And for years, to this day, you can listen on the 70s channel, XM Satellite Radio, and you hear him do a promo saying, "Good night, John Boy. Good night, Grandpa." It was like it became a catchphrase. So for 9 years, we tuned in and we watched the Waltons go through their ups and downs and their ins and outs, their triumphs and their tragedies. And it mirrored, I think, so much of what most people dealt with on an ongoing basis. So I went back, I found this, I'm listening to it, and I'm listening to Earl's voice. I am so glad I kept this stuff, because as I'm listening to him talk, he's alive again to me. The lessons, the commentary, the perspective, you know, 13 years ago, so many years after the show was canceled, of course, like I said, it runs in syndication all over the world, it just lifted me. To hear his voice lifted me. And I thought about our conversations off the air. I remember one time I was living in Upper Michigan, and he had been on the show the day before, and I don't know what else was going on, something, and I was a Saturday afternoon, summertime. I was out in the yard, and I was grilling whatever, and my cell phone rings. And I look up, and it says EH on my cell phone from probably in the early 2000s. Flip phone. Remember those? He just called to say thanks for all the conversations we've had and the opportunity to talk about the things that are important and all this stuff. And I kind of just sat there a little gaga, because it's one thing to have on-air conversations, which I've had for decades. It's another thing for someone to reach out after that happens and thank you. It's very rare. I've always made a point to thank my guests after I talk with them. I either pick up the phone before, you know, they were done, and before I let them go, I'd thank them, or I'd call them the next day, because it was imperative to me to thank them for the time they're taking, whether it was an Earl Hamner or Christopher Reeve or it doesn't matter who, or people you've never heard of before, one and done. And when we had that conversation on that Saturday afternoon, I was just so struck with the authenticity of the man. It wasn't about the Waltons television show or anything that we had or selling books. He surely didn't need my help to do that. But it was just this simple, down-home, neighborly, thank you, John. And when I heard his voice again on this audio, I went right back to that Saturday afternoon. So, without further delay, here's a little bit of Earl Hamner. You're going to hear a caller later in this clip. Gina calls in to talk about the impact that the Waltons had on her life. And the most profound part of this to me, I believe she had gotten rid of cable TV for a period of time because the programming was so horrible then, she just didn't want to deal with it. Look at where we're at now. Here's Earl Hamner. Earl Hamner joining me this afternoon from Studio City, California. You know, Earl, I can imagine your house. You said 1961 you've been there since?
Yes.
1961. And so I'm imagining how many dinners and holidays you've had and all the things. I mean, that's a show in itself.
You mean the staying in that one house?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a very pleasant area. It's where the working class people live here, you know, not the movie stars.
Sure.
And it's a lot of people move to this area. And then when they start making a lot of money, then they move to Beverly Hills.
Right.
And I started making some money, but I liked it where I was so much that we just stayed.
There you go.
And also, there were crowds of children for my kids to play with. And
there you go.
We loved that.
Not to mention all the animals.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite passages from the Avocado Drive Zoo, the chapters, was about your cleaning lady that's out there. What did she think was in the house? It was a...
Well, actually, a friend had sent us a little baby alligator.
Yeah.
And we didn't know what to do with it, so we put it in the bathtub. And when she came to work, she said, "I'm quitting. I don't work for anybody that puts rattlesnakes in the bathtub."
But she did stick around for a little while.
A little bit,
yeah.
Yes.
A little bit. The book, Earl Hamner, it's by James E. Person. It's called Earl Hamner from Walton's Mount to Tomorrow. Was it difficult for you, Earl, to have somebody kind of dog you around a little bit and snoop around and find out what's going on and talk to all your friends and all like that?
Well, not at all. They say you should never let a Virginian get started talking about himself or he'll never shut up. And I think that was the case with Jim Person. I just never shut up.
Were you surprised that you were even approached? I know that in the some of the writings you talk about that you can't imagine anyone wanting to read a book about you, but were you surprised when Jim approached you?
Well, actually, initially, he approached me about doing an article, and I thought, well, yeah, that would be fun. But then when he decided to go for a full biography, I thought, well, that won't take long. But he did such a wonderful job, and I love the book. The preface is by a marvelous young Kentucky writer.
Oh, the preface of the book?
Yeah.
It's Silas House.
Silas House, who I had met many years ago at a book convention.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned for the first time that Silas had named his first novel Clay's Quilt, and then they named his character Clay after Clay in Spencer's Mountain. And I learned a lot of stuff about myself that I didn't know. But, you know, there's some wonderful pictures of me growing up and people from the Waltons, and it's like a family album in many ways. It's nice comments by members of the Walton cast, and one that I'm really particularly fond of is a writer I've admired so many years named Harper Lee, mm-hmm. who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, and she has made a nice comment about my work.
And, you know, so, I also noticed a little bit from Paul Harvey in there.
Yes, yes, yes. He's been such a good friend and a fan. Imagine mm-hmm. having Paul Harvey for a fan.
Imagine that. Here's what I liked about what he said. Author Earl Hamner's influence on our national character has a deserved proper biography. If you find yourself in these pages, good for you. I really like that.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, he's a very astute man, of course.
You know, we're going to, I have to try to just adjust my clock here for time a little bit. We still have a little bit of time together, but
good.
I want to make sure that everything works together as it should. Now, Gina, are you there?
Yes, I am.
We'll say hello to Earl Hamner.
Hi, Earl Hamner.
Hi, Gina.
How are you?
I'm wonderful. Nice to hear your voice.
It's nice to hear yours, too. I've been reading about you.
Do you like what you read? Or what?
Yes, you like to fish. Any man that loves to fish is a
great, good.
So that is really wonderful. Yeah. I've been reading about all your wonderful things you've done all over the world, and you've written so much. And what really surprised me was The Twilight Zone.
Mm.
Oh, yeah, everybody thinks that. But you know what I did in all of my scripts? I wrote stories about Southern people, about folkish kind of themes and folklore. So Rod Serling always said that I brought a hillbilly aspect to The Twilight Zone.
Oh, what you brought was a realism that is just missing from TV today.
Well, it's a form of writing that I really love, and, you know, started as far back as with Edgar Allan Poe, and continues today with Ray Bradbury. Unfortunately, Rod left us much too young,
mm-hmm.
or he would have had an even more brilliant career ahead, I think.
Oh, yes.
He's a nice man, really.
Very, very good, wonderful.
Gina,
good friend. He took a job that I vacated in Cincinnati, Ohio, because I went on to write novels, and Rod just got her to college. So he took the job that I left. And then later, out here at parties, I would run into him, and he would introduce me as the man who gave him his first job.
Now, Gina, you had sent me an email earlier about Earl, and you captured it perfectly about, you know, does he know how much influence on the American landscape that show had? And I'll give you about 30 seconds or 40 seconds to let him know about that, and we're going to have to cut you loose.
Okay. I wanted to touch base with you on the amount of families that would say, when they say goodnight, they say it very differently because of your show. They all say, good night, Tommy. Good night, Jane. Good night, Joe. They say, good night, Mary Ellen. Good night, John Boy. Every family that I stayed with, our own family, just imagine how many families in the last, how long has it been, 30 years?
Yeah.
Has said that. I have been with countless friends and families from all over the United States. And that's something we all do. Now, what that does, it tied us in with the Waltons, and what that did for a lot of people, no matter the backgrounds of the people, the income, the hardships, it tied us in with a family that worked hard, They had great working ethics, their accomplishments, and then their love for each other. It made everyone feel good, and that's what's missing from today.
Indeed.
Good feel-good movies and shows.
You can't imagine how good it makes me feel for you to say that.
Oh, well, I'll tell you, I have been without cable for 14 years, and that and the biggest reason is because of shows that aren't on, like the Waltons and things like that, anymore. There's too much of the other stuff on nowadays.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Earl, I wish we had more time. We're going to have to bring you back and line the other people up because all the rest of the phone lines are ringing, too. We just don't have time to do that today. Gina, we appreciate the phone call.
Thank you. No problem. Thank you, Gina. Thank you, Earl. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
As Gina was pointing out, there's a lot of stuff that isn't there for people anymore, and you still bring the good stuff. And I just want to thank you so much for your friendship over the years and your support of my work. And right back to you, the book is named Earl Hamner from Walton's Mountain to Tomorrow. You can find it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and bookstores everywhere. Earl, I appreciate it.
Goodbye from California. Lovely to have been with you.
Thank you, sir. So this is a guy who had a huge, successful career in Hollywood. I remember him telling me one time he could write anything and everything. He was truly a Renaissance man, I think I want to say it that way. He covered so much ground. And when you get a chance, at least this is how I felt. I felt like he was a mentor without knowing he was a mentor. Because when I went back and started looking at his career and his life, there were similarities in some of the things that we had done. Some of our interests were the same. Because of that, it was a bit of a guidepost for me. You never know when it's going to change. You never know when your success might come, as defined by me, not by who listens or what have you. And I remember him talking about his start long before the Waltons, of a show that used to scare the living crap out of me, which was The Twilight Zone. You heard them talking about that in a clip for a second. It was in the 1960s. Earl contributed 8 episodes to that science fiction series, Twilight Zone. His first script was an acceptance. And because of Rod Serling, this was his big break in Hollywood. There was no Walton stuff. There was no Goodnight, John Boy. This was creepy shit. And he wrote it because he could pull things, as I've learned over the years, he could pull things literally out of thin air and take thoughts and ideas and concepts and distill them into something that moved people. One way, it could scare you, it could bring a tear to your eye, makes you want to go out and eat some apple pie and wave the flag, whatever it is. And then he also went on to write episodes or co-write episodes of Gentle Ben, which was another one of these shows. Like, it was only on for like 3 or 4 years, but it was another one of those, like, well, that, how did he do that? And then he went on to write for The Nanny and The Professor, another big hit. All of those things led him to the break that really popped the cork for him and Jane and his family, which was, of course, the Waltons. So every conversation I had with him, and what you just heard in his voice to me, was this almost like a professor without knowing what the curriculum was whenever I talked to this guy. It just oozed out of him. And as a writer myself, I had sent him a couple of half-finished, what I thought were half-finished pieces of work, and he would take the time. You know, he didn't do a lot of email, but he would write a longhand letter, or my favorite, which is he would type, put a sheet of paper in the typewriter, and he had a typewriter that had an E that was misformed or missing or something. The man could afford 100 typewriters. He used this typewriter, and wherever the E was missing, he had gone back in and penciled a small E in or a capital E to complete a word or what have you. And I still have that letter. And his encouragement was, I think you have the first quarter of something. I'm thinking I'm halfway through, and he says it's a quarter. But he encouraged me to continue to do these things. And I'm not unique in this. This is not like he just did this for me. I know for a fact that when people reached out to him, he reached back. It's the barrel of monkeys theory. We're all monkeys in the barrel. We're all trying to get up to the next level in some way, shape, or form. And when one of the monkeys gets up to the next level, we go, look, that monkey made it, so I can make it. And there was a game when I was a kid called, coincidentally, Barrel of Monkeys. And their arms were shaped like S's. And so there was red ones and blue ones, I think. I don't remember if there was any other colors. But I got this for Christmas one year. And the whole concept was you take one monkey out of the barrel and you hook another monkey's arm. And then you hook another monkey's arm. And there was, I don't know, 50 monkeys in the barrel. And the idea was to keep hooking the longest chain of monkeys to get them out of the barrel. And inevitably, you know, my arms were short, or I'd drop one or sneeze or who knows what. and you got to start over again. And I've always felt that's kind of like how life is. There are monkeys that are able to get out of the barrel. If they're worth their character and they've learned their lessons, they will reach back and grab another monkey and say, come on. And then you go grab another monkey, come on and go. So every time I talked to this guy, I felt like he was reaching out his arm and saying, come on, John. Come on. See, I could do this. I'm no different than you. I have some different disciplines and some different rituals, and I've had a couple of breaks, and it was a little bit of different genre. But the basic outline of what he did was to take thought and put it into word and then reach out to the world. On my trusty, dusty 8-year-old Dell laptop, which is just like the best thing going, I have my background is Earl Hamner. I kind of rotated in and out, but mostly because I just listened to this clip, is Earl Hamner sitting in his house in Schuyler, Virginia, in his bedroom as an elderly man, looking out the window with a typewriter in front of him and his hands on that typewriter. And there's it's a threadbare place. And so he sat there, just like Richard Thomas did in the show, and he would have these thoughts, and he would either write them down, and later on eventually got a typewriter. There was a whole episode around getting a typewriter, I believe. And this was how he created. And so I look at myself as a writer. Most of the stuff I do now is on a laptop computer. I don't do anything longhand. I could barely write my signature anymore. That's why I sign all these books. People are like, do you mind signing it? No, I sign books so I don't forget how to write cursive. But it's all done on a laptop. And it's dumped into the landfill of Facebook at this point. I did a blog for years, Notes from the North, on my website, and it got buried. And it's like, it is not worth trying to get people to move over here to go. So I just put it on every now and again, the Wednesday rant or what have you, and try to make some sense of the senseless and do something about 1,000 words or less. It keeps my mind sharp. So Earl never blogged. He never threw stuff in the landfill of Facebook. He would sit and write longhand and use his ancient typewriter with the E missing, and he just reached out to the world. One of the things that I think the big aha or the big takeaway from this is, and I'm just going to set you up for some future episodes, there's probably 6 or 8 people in some of these clips that are now no longer with us, and Earl's one of them. I think about that a lot, and mostly it comes down to the fact that, you know, our ego thinks that everybody else dies and we don't, and no matter how successful you are, how much money you have, we already know. On some level, on a truth level, that doesn't matter. It's coming for everybody. We're all going to die. That's a fact. I'm just not sure if we all truly live until that day comes. Doesn't mean life's any easier or better if you have this big awareness or awakening, but I think it gives an urgency to not wasting a whole lot of time and not majoring in minor things. And the simplicity of life on Walton's Mountain, and the simplicity of what the messages were at a very difficult time on television that came from another very difficult time should be an antidote to some degree to the difficult times we live in now. Because that's really the overarching deal here, isn't it? There's no such thing as the good old days. It's just how you saw them. There's never been the good old days, because for every good old day, there was a bad old day. And we think there shouldn't be, and so I think we get stuck in that stuff. Remember how it used to be? Well, yeah, wasn't it a great show and life was great? I've talked about this a little bit before. Growing up and, you know, only focused on the Chicago Cubs in 1969 winning the pennant, I thought life was great. Hot dogs, watch the ball game, go play catch with my buddies. But the war was going on and people weren't coming home. And as my consciousness expanded and I started to see these things, that stuff became even more important, because I think it's the anchor that holds us to the truth of who we are on some level, no matter what kind of shit's hitting the fan. That's why these things are important. So thanks for spending a little bit of time on the Life 2.0 TBT podcast today. I want to thank you again for being a subscriber and supporting the work and spreading the word. Until next time, safe travels. Adios.